I pulled out the directory and started calling every single person in the directory saying, "Hi, my name's Caitlin and I'm a Girl Scout and I'm selling cookies." And, you know, I had a little pitch and I called and I sold the most cookies out of any brownie in Colorado. I spent the entire weekend at my aunt's house creating a Beanie Baby like how-to pamphlet or something, and then proceeded to go to first grade and sell it to all my classmates as like, this is how you know which Beanie Babies you should get. And I sold it for something like a dollar. I was president of my school, which was a K-8 school. I'm Caitlin Clark, I'm your next door neighbor, and told the story about my friend, and he's not getting properly taken care of. And I know you're on the board, and I would just really appreciate if you looked into this. 24 hours later, I get a phone call from my girlfriend's mom saying, "Oh my gosh, like he's been put in a different room. The doctors are seeing him every hour on the hour. He's already like improving." So basically, there's a problem, I'm gonna solve it. It's advocacy, but it's also just thinking out of the box, which I equate to synonymous with entrepreneurship. Figured out in my head was that my parents can't say no for me going to school for theater if I get the same amount or more in scholarship funding as I did for violin. I'm so grateful that that's what I did. Just the communication, the self-awareness, the public speaking skills. Yes, that was where I realized real early on that I will not be able to have a desk job because my mom was having my youngest brother, Brendan. Well, 6 months after she had him, she found a lump in her breast.
Wow.
And was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 41. Performed a lumpectomy and then chemo and radiation. And she was cancer-free for 15 years.
Oh, fantastic.
And she says, "I just had my annual mammogram." I said, "Well, okay, how did it go?" She said, "Well, oh, fine, same results. The MRI doesn't show anything, but when they test her blood, her tumor markers are high." So then the last thing that's left is an ultrasound. And they say to her, "Listen, you're 15 years out from your primary breast cancer. Insurance isn't going to cover this breast ultrasound." So we get the ultrasound and I remember it so vividly. And she walks in, she looks straight at my mom and goes, "Lisa, you have a ton of cancer. We tested you for this thing called a hereditary cancer gene and you're positive for that, it's BRCA1. After Christmas, I decided with 1 month left of college to drop out and be my mom's full-time caregiver. I don't know, do you remember when Angelina Jolie came out, the New York Times article? So that mutation that she had, and the reason she had those surgeries was because she had the same mutation my mom had. The difference is that Angelina Jolie was tested because her physician told her she needed to be. And so she was able to make decisions to act proactively so that she would not get breast or ovarian cancer. So, you know, my mom's death could have been prevented had she had the proper surgery. And she's like kind of shaking and goes, "Are you telling me I wouldn't have to be here?" And what she's reading is the article in the New York Times and it's clicking for her, "Oh shit, I could have done this and I wouldn't be dying." A couple days later, she told me, "You know, Caitlin, you need to go get tested for this thing too." So I go, I am 22 and I say, "Hey, I'd like this test." And she goes, "Oh, you're too young, you don't need that."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "I'm pretty sure my genetics don't change with age, so can I just get it?"
Uh-huh.
And she says, "Oh, yeah, but it's not gonna affect how I take care of you."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Okay, I mean, I'm sure you're right. You're the expert here, but, and also it's a guideline, like give it to me, lady." I ended up creating a scene. I was like, "Listen, my mom is on her deathbed. I'm not leaving here until you test me." So she did. 2 weeks later, she called me with my positive result. Predisposes you to getting breast cancer. It increases your risk to 90% in your lifetime and 63% for ovarian cancer, as well as increases your risks for melanoma and pancreatic cancer. So I chose not to tell her. She dies August 2nd, 2013. Okay, so the physician palpates my breast lumps and says, "You know, this doesn't look or feel like breast cancer. Plus you're only 22, there's no way. Still I want an MRI or a mammogram or an ultrasound, I want something." And she's like, "Well, you realize that I'm gonna have to order what's called non-clinically necessary because you're so young. Well, if I'm dead, I'm not gonna have to worry about the bill." I get a phone call from the physician saying, "Oh, hey, it's benign. There's no evidence of cancer. Atypical hyperplasia is a future indicator of cancer." And the radiologist looked at my age of being 22 and the atypia and said, "It's just dense breast tissue.
Right.
You're so young, most women your age have it." And I called bullshit. So I, again, did more research. I spoke with physicians from all over. I met with, and I made the decision to have what's called a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy, which is the removal of both breasts. Well, 4 days after my surgery, I was called with my pathology report, and they'd found breast cancer. I was 24 years old, but because I had acted proactively, I did not have to have chemo and I did not have to have radiation. Yeah, and you know, the really difficult thing, and this goes into a lot of the stigma with women's health, is I received so much you know, condemnation and criticism about me making that decision at such a young age and being a woman. So then I felt that that was like my calling had been recognized, that what my mom went through and what I went through was to lead me to what I'm doing now. Ended up becoming a national speaker for Bright Pink, which is a nonprofit that focuses on education and early detection for women between the ages of 18 and 45 for breast and ovarian cancer. And then from there, I was headhunted by the number one genetic testing company in the world, Myriad, to be a national patient speaker for them, realizing it's like I had this patient experience with both my mom and me, and then now I kind of had this behind the door view of healthcare.
Right.
And I was realizing that it's about quantity, not quality. The more time I spend with a patient means the fewer patients I'm going to see, which means a smaller paycheck. I quit my job, and honestly, I did not know what I was going to do. I just knew that I was angry, that I was not having enough impact, and that things weren't changing. One in three women will get a female cancer in their lifetime. 60% of those cancers are preventable. 60%.
Uh-huh.
40% of those cancers happen due to delayed diagnosis. The root of the problem is that women don't know what's going on with their breasts and vaginas, and that leads to delayed diagnosis, perpetuating shame, and an increase in disease incidence. If women know their bodies, if they know what's going on, then they know when something's abnormal. Then they can have, and if they have access to quality information to know these things, and then to track and watch and see, talk with women who maybe have similar symptoms, then something can be found before it is life-threatening. By equipping the woman with the proper tools, the information to have an informed conversation with her physician, then we can partner with our physicians to make sure that delayed diagnosis doesn't occur. In March of this last year, I had my ovaries and fallopian tubes removed preventatively because I have a really high ovarian cancer risk. There is no reason for me to sit on this if there's something I can do. I am BRCA1 positive. I had a preventative double mastectomy that resulted in finding breast cancer. I am such and such age. This was my result on my last transvaginal ultrasound. I don't want to have children, so I would like to have my ovaries and fallopian tubes removed. One question I said, and I answered it, and she goes, okay, sounds like you thought through this. Let's do it.
Fantastic.
That experience was wildly different than the one that I had with my breasts. If women are the experts, then that can happen. Then not only can we have better experiences, and that's a personal decision. By no means am I recommending that every woman do that. Women just need access to quality content. Women needed something that was with them all the time, every day. Who taught you how to insert a tampon? 90% of the women at these focus groups were not taught and had to figure it out on their own. That, of course, led to the number of women who don't know how to perform a self-breast exam. So Gabby is an app that makes women the experts on their body. I need someone who is just as passionate as me, but I can't rush the process of bringing someone on who's going to be so highly influential and a big part. This needs to be built by women for women. Yeah. They're also the ones who realize how big the market is. This is a multi-trillion dollar market.
You're trying to make a for-profit company.
Yes. Gabby is a for-profit company. We have a foundation arm. Every purchase that is made, a woman in need of healthcare services will be supported. But I feel like we can do bigger and greater things by being a for-profit company. To be partnering with businesses, so health insurers, and then as an add-on to cost savings that we provide by getting women to be using Gabby is astronomical for insurance companies.
Yes.
We're gonna launch this crowdfunding campaign and then have that up for about a month, get money from that. That is what I need to surround myself with, people who have done this before, who are experienced, and identify who are those people that I'm gonna trust and ask for wisdom, because so much of this is like the blind leading the blind. And honestly, like, especially when you're a solo founder, you have to do that. And I think even if you're not a solo founder, you have to talk with people who are in a similar space. You know, I am out to create systemic change. I am out to have impact. So I started with my mom, right? Well, her her full name is Lisa Gabrielle Tevenet Clark. And so Gabrielle, obviously, Gabby comes from Gabrielle. My mom and I were both often said we were too opinionated, too strong, too talkative. And I think one of the strongest qualities of women is that we share information. Female health startups that are by men, because I think that's wrong.
Sure.
Differentiator is that we're solely focusing on prevention, and it's things that can be prevented, stats that need to be met. You know, decreasing delayed diagnosis is very specific.
Yes.
And that's what we're doing. And in doing so, we're wanting to get women to talk about their bodies, to not have the shame and stigma of learning how to put in a tampon, of being okay talking about those subjects. That we're creating not just a company, but a movement. We want to be in your hands all the time. We want to be your best friend, your resource that you go to, that you can trust, which then burns you out and then sick. Like, I got the flu in July.
Right.
Who does that happen to? No one.
Founders.
Yeah.
Okay. Caitlin, how do you believe you have grown as an entrepreneur? In what way?
I think my personality is that I like to be in control. And I've gotten okay or more comfortable with the unknown, with being uncomfortable. And I think as a business owner in the startup world, you have to be. Oh, like being okay not being in control all the time.
Yeah.
You can sign up to be on our newsletter list. You can take the risk assessment that's online and follow us on social media, begabby.com. So BEGABBI.com. Our social media handles are BeGabby.
Hello, startup hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
Welcome to Startup Hunter. I am here with Caitlin Christine. And she is the founder of Gabby, which is making women the experts on their body.
Yes.
And I am so honored that you came on my show. So thank you so much.
I'm so excited to be doing this with you here in New York.
What we do that on this show is we go all the way back. So Caitlin.
All the way back, okay.
I would like to know, where were you born and what did your parents do?
Okay, I was born in Santa Monica, California.
Wow.
My parents met after my mom was runner-up for Miss United States, and she was trying to make it big as a model, and then was really struggling to pay the bills, and she had four different jobs. So she was recruited by one of her friends to work for Mary Kay Cosmetics, and very shortly she started making enough money to quit one job after the other, and so she was working full-time for Mary Kay. And my father was working for Disney.
Aha. Uh-huh. So neither of your parents were officially entrepreneurs?
No, not officially. However, you know, in Mary Kay, it's your own business that you get to manage. So
right.
My mom was very much an entrepreneur. And she ended up being one of the most successful national sales director for Mary Kay. And then my father, we moved to Denver in the mid-90s. And he then started his own company. So both parents are entrepreneurs.
So what was your dad's company?
He started a private equity and investment firm in Denver.
So I think that's a really cool kind of business, just because like I have this romantic view of, you know, Wall Street in the 60s or the 70s and, you know, the guys with their ties and boardrooms and, but any kind of, you know, even a financial business is a startup.
Totally.
of some degree, probably. You know, the word startup sort of means like super scalable.
Yes. Right. And he wasn't necessarily a startup. I mean, don't get me wrong. This was a very small local firm in Colorado, but absolutely, he was an entrepreneur.
Well, Colorado's really interesting, you know, from a financial perspective, because you've got Aspen and you've got Telluride?
Yeah, Aspen, Telluride, Vail.
And I, yeah.
Boulder.
Been to Vail. And Boulder's like very much like Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Like the most super, super space age and spacey.
Right, modern.
So wait, you moved to Denver?
Moved to Denver.
That's super cool. I have two questions.
Okay.
One, do you think any of your dads, well, both of your parents were very entrepreneurial. So how do you think that rubbed off on you?
Okay, so how did my parents being entrepreneurs affect me?
Yes. Do you feel like you absorbed some of it by osmosis, or can you remember some stories, you know, about maybe helping them?
Totally. Yes. So I have actually quite a few stories. I think the first one would be, so my mom was a national sales director for Mary Kay Cosmetics, and their whole tagline is enriching women's lives. And I think a lot of people, they think of Mary Kay, especially who haven't been in that pink bubble, they think of it as makeup. Uh-huh. But my mom would always say, like, I do this because I want to help change women's lives. She was working with women who oftentimes were either single moms or didn't have a college education, and trying to help them to get out of kind of the poverty cycle and to take initiative so that they could be empowered to have a better life.
So, like, she would, like, hire women to, like, start their own?
No, she just was, the women that she was recruiting into Mary Kay happened to be these women that were super driven and smart, but because of one reason or another, they, you know, were the breadwinners and they weren't making enough money, or they didn't have the time. And so she was trying to help them realize a different way to be successful. And so one of the things, the story my mom would always tell actually, is that I heard this dialogue coming from her about positivity. Mm-hmm. You know, she would always say these very cheesy lines that now, of course, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like my mother and mom was right. Of like, one of my favorites is, what you think about, you bring about. And so she would say that all the time, and she would say these very uplifting, kind of encouraging, positive affirmations. So one day we were actually moving between from this house behind us to the other one. My baby brother was being born and we needed more space. And I had my neighborhood friend over and we were like on the monkey bars or something. And I jumped off and she didn't want to jump off. She was scared of heights. And my mom said, I don't remember this, but my mom said she heard me go, Shelby, be like the little engine that could. You can do it.
Was that Shelby's your nickname?
No, Shelby was my friend that was there. And so I basically told her, like, think positively. You can do it. I believe in you. And she jumped off and she was fine.
Yeah.
And so, like, think that's part of it is the whole, like, empowering and positive thinking. Another story is that I think very early on, my parents very much taught us that, like, you don't have to follow the rules in that there's always a way. Mm-hmm. So for example, I was in Brownies for 1 year. Brownies is like the lower level of Girl Scouts. And I wanted some prize. So we go to our Brownie troop meeting and they hand out the forms and everything to start doing it. And I went to, my parents were part of this entrepreneurial organization that's worldwide. And they had just started getting into it.
Do you remember the name of this?
Yes, Young President's Organization.
I literally was just at a YPO thing.
Yeah.
And so there, more synchronicity.
Right. So I pulled out the directory. They were part of the Rocky Mountain chapter. I pulled out the directory and started calling every single person in the directory saying, hi, my name's Caitlin and I'm a Girl Scout and I'm selling cookies.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a little pitch and I called and I sold the most cookies out of any brownie in Colorado.
So I would, yeah, I mean, it's so smart. And of anybody who would understand the struggle of a beginning entrepreneur, it's another entrepreneur.
Totally.
And I think that's a really great story. It's really warm.
And I mean, I have more if you want more.
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
So this was like in the early 90s when Beanie Babies were a thing.
I remember the name. What do they look like again?
They're like literally little stuffed animals, maybe yay big, stuffed with beans, small beans. And they're like by the company TY, I think it was. And they had like the red heart little tag. And they were all different animals. And I don't know why they were so popular, but and then, you know, they had like limited editions ones for Princess Diana. And anyways, so I was really into them. I was collecting them. And honestly, I have no idea how I came up with this idea, but I was at my Aunt Susie's in Boulder with my cousin. And we were like researching the latest Beanie Babies and you know, asking for certain ones for Christmas or something. And I started realizing that a lot of people didn't know like what the value was of each Beanie Baby, because certain ones, like limited edition ones, were more expensive. And so I spent the entire weekend at my aunt's house creating a Beanie Baby like how-to pamphlet or something, and then proceeded to go to first grade and sell it to all my classmates as like, this is how you know which Beanie Babies you should get. And I sold it for something like a dollar. So
were you open to trading one for lunch, you know, like a piece of candy from lunch? Or
no, I was very, you know, I'm like, no, give me the money, or if you had something I wanted, sure, but I don't remember that being a thing.
It's really interesting, I think, how a child, you know, when a child's born, they have no concept of money, but society teaches us that if you have something, you know, you exchange it for money, and you learn that as a kid. And it's just really interesting how kids develop a relationship with money.
Yeah. Well, and what I would say is that so I have two younger brothers, and out of all of us, we were always saying my baby brother, and I'm sure he still will be, is probably going to be the most successful. And he was like an entrepreneur from day one. And I have crazy stories about him too. So we all kind of were. My middle brother.
There's three of you.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you're the oldest.
I am the oldest and only girl. Anyways, all that to say, we all had some level of like the entrepreneur gene in us.
So what other stories do you have of your young hustles? By the way, I didn't even get to ask my question. You literally answered the first question of the show.
Oh.
Or the second question of the show, which is typically, what's your first hustle?
Oh, first hustle. Oh,
so
yeah.
But you literally went into that already.
Yeah. Let's see, what was some other hustles? And this isn't necessarily a business, but I was president of my school, which was a K-8 school. And so, you know, I campaigned and led the student body, and that was very much of something. I remember working with my parents on what my slogan was going to be. And birth name, last name, surname was Clark. And my middle brother couldn't say Caitlin when I was younger. So I was KK until college. So my slogan, I do remember this, was make your mark, vote KK Clark.
There you go. It has a ring.
Yeah.
And fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of those things. This is one of those situations when I wish that, you know, my mom was still here. She would have all these stories. But those are the ones that I remember most. Yeah. I think I also have other examples, I think, of advocacy. So for me, those are the two things that have always really been ingrained, at least in my person, is the kind of advocacy and empowerment, like the story on the jungle gym, and then the entrepreneurship.
What was the next thing that you did that was entrepreneurial?
After that?
Yeah.
Ooh. I would say in, two come to mind. The first one was that, this is high school. Yeah, so the first one was I had a neighbor who I didn't know very well, but his husband had an accident similar to Christopher Reeves. And so she was a quadriplegic after a horseback riding incident. And that's kind of just background information. So I had a girlfriend at the time who was in college. And my friends were always older. So I'm in high school. She's at CU Boulder, and her boyfriend gets in a snowboarding accident and becomes a quad. And in Denver, we have one of the best spinal cord injury hospitals in the nation called Craig Hospital. And it just happened to be just down the street from, you know, where we all lived. And anyways, he was there for like 3 months, and it was going downhill. The next thing you know, he's getting pneumonia and he's getting infections, and he's lost like so much weight. And I was going and visiting him with her at least weekly, if not more than a couple times a week. And there was a point where they were like, we're gonna lose him.
Wow.
Because they weren't able to find doctors to talk to. They weren't giving accurate, you know, information. There was a lag in the care. And so I remember that my neighbor's wife was a quadriplegic. And again, this is a gentleman I've never met in my life. The wife who was a quadriplegic, her husband, but I knew he was on the board at Craig Hospital. So I marched over to next door and
you were like,
11, 12, 13?
Yeah, I'm thinking, so I'm in high school, I'm probably more like 14, 15.
Okay.
And I'm like, hi, I'm Caitlin Clark, I'm your next door neighbor, and told the story about my friend, and he's not getting properly taken care of. And I know you're on the board, and I would just really appreciate if you looked into this, because, you know, I don't think that you want Craig Hospital to have this reputation. And you know what, he was fine a month ago or something, and he's just not getting taken care of. So all I remember is that 24 hours later, I get a phone call from my girlfriend's mom saying, oh my gosh, like, he's been put in a different room. The doctors are seeing him every hour on the hour. He's already like improving. And so he had done something, he had called. And then I got a letter from him saying, I just remember, and I saved it. I actually found it a couple months ago, talking about how he thinks I'm the most formidable woman he's ever met. And I don't even remember the conversation. I don't really remember the logistics of what I said to him.
So is he okay? Is he better now?
Oh, so Corey, my friend's boyfriend, now has a very full life. You know, he got out of the hospital a month later and finished college. And yeah, I mean, incredible. Great. So that's one of those things I think is like advocacy. And also, you know, basically there's a problem, I'm going to solve it, kind of thing.
Uh-huh. Some of these problems take a lifetime to solve.
Totally. The second one, again, which I think it's advocacy, but it's also just thinking out of the box, which I equate to synonymous with entrepreneurship.
Yes.
Is that I, so University of Denver is where I went to college, and originally I wanted to go to the East Coast, but again, I have younger brothers and we were really close and I didn't want to leave my boys. So I decided I was going to go to DU, University of Denver. And I had actually gotten a pretty hefty scholarship for the violin. I played the violin.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. My family was all very much about success and achievement, and that was kind of your measure of worth. And
here's a question.
Yeah.
And here, this is like all startup alley.
Mm-hmm.
Like with the,
okay.
This is super, super startup.
Feel free to point out whatever if.
So you said your family placed a lot of value on success. Do you feel that there was anything like too much pressure? Like was it, because I feel there was a lot of that with me and I feel like caved from the pressure. And I'm like, I don't need this, stop bothering me. I wanna, you know, ride my bicycle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was, I think there's a line and no one knows what that line is, and it's probably different for every child or every person too. But I think there's a healthy amount of pressure and achievement that is important, and then there's unhealthy. And I would definitely say that mine very much ventured into unhealthy.
Okay. So, and as a kid, you just don't have the strength or awareness or, you know, courage to say, guys, you know, leave me be.
Well, and you know, they are your providers, they're the ones who give you love, and
right.
So you don't want to disappoint them, and you don't know that other people don't have that scenario, that there's not that pressure on everyone.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what was the story I was going to tell? Oh, so violin. So in order for me to go to college for violin, it was, you're not just going to college on a violin scholarship, it is that you are going to become a concert violinist.
Uh-huh.
The best, you know, whatever. And I had zero interest in that.
Right.
Violin was very much a passion thing for me, connecting with music. It was a very spiritual thing for me. And I didn't want to be the best at violin. So I had done some theater in high school and had really enjoyed that. I was always very good at public speaking, you know, on the debate team, etc.
Debate? See, I wish I had done debate team. I think I would have been great at it.
Yeah, I think, yeah, a lot of people who, you know, have these pressures and are well-spoken are great at debate. So
maybe I should find a debate club that's like for adults.
Oh, I think that'd be way cool. I would participate.
Cool.
I was like, you know what? I did some research on other scholarships and found that DU had a scholarship for acting, for theater.
Yeah.
And now, mind you, I had very minimal experience. And it's not like DU was the best, I mean, it's not Juilliard, but it definitely is, they can call it like the Ivy League of the Rocky Mountains, which is so dumb. But I mean, so it was a good school. And what I'm saying is the theater program was not incredibly robust, but it was there.
There was still a theater program.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply for this theater scholarship. And what I figured out in my head was that my parents can't say no for me going to school for theater if I get the same amount or more in scholarship funding as I did for violin. So that was my goal. And I did it.
Did they try to twist your arm? Did they try to, like, how, what was their reaction?
Well, so again, achievement, success, family. They're like, what are you going to do with a theater degree? How, that, you know, that's not going to pay the bills, blah, 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 blah. And I actually was written up in an article a year ago about how theater degrees are incredibly valuable.
Yeah, oh, I think so.
I am so grateful that that's what I did. Just the communication, the self-awareness, the public speaking skills, the getting outside of yourself and seeing other perspectives. I mean, I think it's an invaluable degree. So, but you know, my parents, it's like, they considered me going to school for basket weaving. You know, to them it was like, you can't do anything for this.
Right, you were taking like the modern dance, you know,
right.
Stereotypical, you know, artsy-fartsy
yeah.
degree.
Yeah.
How you, there's no skills here.
No.
But maybe a too narrow of a view. There is some practical reality
sure.
in that breaking through as an actor is like almost,
super hard.
It's like one in a trillion.
Right.
To actually make, most actors are waiters for 20 years,
yeah.
you know, or have some side job while they do yeah. acting, you know.
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, this goes into a whole other tangent, but yeah. unless you're that person that was born and was like, I am going to be a lawyer or a doctor. Like, that's what I want to do. Most people don't. And I think it's, again, with pressure, I think it's too much pressure and unrealistic to say, I need my child to declare their major at 18 and this is what they're going to do for the rest of their life.
But so I did tech for 15 years until I realized I don't like sitting at a desk. You know, I felt like I'm getting diabetes just yeah. by, I felt like my eyeballs were burning out. My job was not to talk to people. I love talking to people. I was always getting up from my desk and yeah. my managers were always saying, you're not at your desk enough. You don't, it doesn't feel like you're being productive. And I always got the things done on time.
Right.
And it was just like something really unbalanced yes. with my former role in that industry.
I have a similar experience. When I told you I lived in New York for a little bit, I came out for an internship at Scholastic Publishing House.
Sure.
And I was working in the foreign rights department and was so excited, you know, New York, oh my gosh. I was miserable because I was sitting in the desk in a little cubicle all day long, 5 days a week, punching in from, you know, 9 to 5. And again, I got everything done. But then during lunch, like my excitement was, I'm gonna go discover New York, which for me meant I'm gonna go eat all the great things.
Uh-huh.
So yes, that was where I realized real early on that I will not be able to have a desk job.
Okay, so I'm loving all these topics and I just want to do chronologically.
Okay.
You do debate.
High school. Debate high school.
And you get to college, you're doing acting.
Yes.
So do you do 4 years of acting?
I did, actually, and this kind of goes into my personal story because I never finished college.
Neither did I.
Okay. I always love meeting people who haven't. And I think also we come from a time, and it's starting to get better, where like you know, college dropout, what a stigma.
I did it for financial reasons. I'm like, I don't feel comfortable taking all your money, Dad. I don't want, you know, I don't want all this guilt, you know. I just like, I'm done, I'm gonna go work.
Well, and I have an argument. Sorry, I interrupted because I know you want us to take this somewhere else. But I think, what you said, throw away all that money. But also, I totally just lost my train of thought. Oh, I think what's happening now today is that, again, unless you're doing a specific trade like lawyer, doctor, that there are. There's so much more room, engineering, yeah. There's so much more room for creativity and kind of making your own path. And I think a college degree is going to be less and less required.
And then talk about dropping out of school.
Yeah. So it was my senior year of college. And I was the lead in the main stage production. And I was doing some food writing. And my mom, so this is kind of going back a little bit, but when my, remember I was telling a story about the house as we were moving to the house that was like right behind the other one, and my friend at the time was jumping off the monkey bars while we were moving because my mom was having my youngest brother, Brendan. Well, 6 months after she had him, she found a lump in her breast.
Wow.
And was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 41. So she, after they performed a lumpectomy and then chemo and radiation, and she was cancer-free for 15 years.
Oh, fantastic.
So fast forward to November of 2012, and I'm home for Thanksgiving. My mom always hosted Thanksgiving. She's one of nine, eight girls, one boy. And we're talking, who's bringing what for Thanksgiving? We're doing the turkey, and Susie's bringing the roasted vegetables, etc. And there's kind of a lull in the conversation. And she says, I just had my annual mammogram. I said, well, okay, how did it go? She said, well, oh, fine. They said it was good, but they want me to do it again. And I said, well, if it was fine, then why do they want you to do it again? She says, I don't really know. They just said my tumor markers were high. And I asked her, what did that mean? And she didn't know either. So I said, well, Mom, I'll go with you. So we go to her mammogram, and the result is negative again. The mammogram is negative, but her tumor markers are high again when they test her blood. So they said, we need to do an MRI. Do an MRI, same results. The MRI doesn't show anything, but when they test her blood, her tumor markers are high. Mm. So then the last thing that's left is an ultrasound. And they say to her, listen, you're 15 years out from your primary breast cancer. Insurance isn't going to cover this breast ultrasound. So you're gonna have to pay for it out of pocket. At the time, my parents had separated. And, you know, my mom was taking care of the kids and the house. And yeah. And we were all at the ages where we're becoming really expensive of like high school and cars and, you know, planning for college and all that. So I was like, Mom, you know, it will eat you up if you don't get this ultrasound. So let's just figure out how to break it up into payments, you know, whatever it is. So we get the ultrasound, and I remember it so vividly. Because I had gone to some of her ultrasounds when she was first diagnosed, when she was 41. And I just remember standing there, she's laying down, the tech is going over a spot in her breast. And I remember looking at the screen, and there was just a big black hole. And I knew, and of course they don't have you look at the screen while they're like, you know, but the big change was then she goes, I'll be right back. And in comes the radiologist, and that's never a good sign.
Right.
So she does her thing and then cleans her up and says, Mrs. Clark, I think it's breast cancer.
Uh-huh.
So long story short, after then getting a biopsy to confirm it's breast cancer, then getting a CT scan to see if it's anywhere else in her body, it was December 21st, 2012, 4 days before Christmas. And we go in to meet with her oncologist, and she walks in, she looks straight at my mom and goes, Lisa, you have a ton of cancer.
Uh-huh.
It's in your breast wall cavity, your liver, your lungs, and your kidneys. And we tested you for this thing called a hereditary cancer gene, and you're positive for that. It's BRCA1.
Uh-huh.
And you also are triple negative, which is the rarest form of breast cancer.
Uh-huh.
And we currently have no way to treat it. So that's kind of when really this huge shift happened. And after Christmas, I decided with 1 month left of college to drop out and be my mom's full-time caregiver.
Wow.
I don't know how to explain how I knew that she was going to die besides doing a lot of research. But I decided that was the thing to do.
I think it's a great thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you did that. Yeah,
so that's why and how I dropped out.
Wow. So where do we go from here?
Yeah. So this, again, is kind of going into my story. I don't know. Do you remember when Angelina Jolie came out, the New York Times article? So that mutation that she had,
yeah.
The reason she had those surgeries was because she had the same mutation my mom had. The difference is that Angelina Jolie was tested because her physician told her she needed to be. And so she was able to make decisions to act proactively so that she would not get breast or ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
My mom did not have that opportunity. So, you know, my mom's death could have been prevented had she had the proper surgery.
Yes.
And it's 3 months before my mom actually passes, and Angelina Jolie comes out with this announcement.
All these things are happening all at the same time.
Right. And I'll never forget, we were at the breakfast table. My mom is like 90 pounds, no hair. Things are just falling off of her. She has a habitual cough. She stopped doing treatment because it's not doing anything. And she's reading her iPad at the breakfast table, and she starts yelling at it. And you know, I run over to her to see why, what's going on. And she's like kind of shaking me, goes, "Are you telling me I wouldn't have to be here?" And what she's reading is the article in the New York Times, and it's clicking for her, oh shit, I could have done this and I wouldn't be dying. And a couple days later, she told me, you know, "Caitlin, you need to go get tested for this thing too." And again, at this point, like, we had not been given a lot of information. It was really difficult to find information about this. So we knew it was genetic, but we didn't know what that meant. We didn't know how severe it was. So I was like, okay, I went to go get tested by my OBGYN, who was my mom's OBGYN, because my mom trusted her, then I trusted her. But this is also the same physician who didn't test her. So I go, I am 22, and I say, "Hey, I'd like this test." And she goes, "Oh, you're too young, you don't need that."
Yeah.
And I'm like, I mean, I'm pretty sure my genetics don't change with age, so can I just get it?
Uh-huh.
And she says, "Oh, yeah, but it's not gonna affect how I take care of you."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Okay, I mean, I'm sure you're right. You're the expert here, but."
You had an intuition.
Yeah, I was like, so, and also it's a guideline, like, give it to me, lady. So, I ended up creating a scene. I was like, "Listen, my mom is on her deathbed. I'm not leaving here until you test me." So she did. 2 weeks later, she called me with my positive result.
So you found that you have the same genetics.
Yes.
Wow.
It predisposes you to getting breast cancer. It increases your risk to 90% in your lifetime and 63% for ovarian cancer, as well as increases your risks for melanoma and pancreatic cancer.
Uh-huh.
So.
This is the BRCA one?
Yes, BRCA one. And I made the decision to not tell my mom.
Okay, yeah.
Because I knew that I had other options, but I also knew that her understanding of the mutation was her dying in her bed. And I didn't want her to think that that was going to be my fate. So I chose not to tell her. She dies August 2nd, 2013. And during this time, I had noticed two lumps in my breasts. So once I got that positive result, I was like, okay, I need to do something about this.
Wow.
I went into a different physician to have him look at it. So the physician palpates my breast lumps and says, "You know, this doesn't look or feel like breast cancer. Plus, you're only 22. There's no way."
Right.
And I'm like, "That's fine, but I'd still I want an MRI or a mammogram or an ultrasound. I want something." And she's like, "Well, you realize that I'm gonna have to order what's called non-clinically necessary because you're so young, and I don't think it looks and feels like breast cancer."
Which is insurance speak.
Exactly.
For...
It's gonna cost you a lot of money. And I was like, "Well, if I'm dead, I'm not gonna have to worry about the bill." This is another change. Physicians do not exert themselves into the whole insurance claims issue, but none of their business. Their job is to give a recommendation. Okay, I don't need to go into that. Sorry.
No.
Tangent.
I'm curious. A physician's job is to give a recommendation only?
To look at what the symptoms the patient is having,
uh-huh.
To listen to the patient. I was actually just reading this, again, this incredible book called The Emperor of All Maladies, and it's about the history of cancer. And the thing that often gets missed and is confusing and difficult for physicians is that they're supposed to use science, but there's also this social component.
Yeah.
Like, you are not just looking at symptoms, you're also having to look at the person, the individual.
Mm.
And that's where, because every human is unique, every symptom is going to look different. So they're supposed to take the social part, the scientific part, and then come up with, you know, a recommendation. And then, you know, it's up to the patient to say, "Yeah, I'm gonna follow that recommendation based on all the information you've provided me here," or all that. So
I just think you're right in like doing what you did already. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure like all the doctors are, you know, saying it's not the right time.
Totally.
You know, but like, I think you had more information and more.
Well, what's amazing is I really didn't have much information. I just kind of had this experience and I did a little research myself, but I mean, this all goes back to why I started Gabby. So, but anyways, I find these lumps. I said, just like, give me the mammogram or MRI. I'll figure out how to pay for it later. And so I got that and the mammogram was concerning. So then they wanted to do an MRI and that was concerning.
Yeah.
So then they wanted to do an ultrasound and that was even more concerning. So they ended up biopsying one of the lumps and the result is what's called atypical hyperplasia. Well, again, I didn't know what this was. I get a phone call from the physician saying, oh, hey, it's benign. There's no evidence of cancer. But so that was exciting. Great. Okay. But then I started doing research and I spoke to a couple other physicians and realized that actually that's not what that means. Atypical hyperplasia is a future indicator of cancer.
Uh-huh.
And the radiologist looked at my age of being 22 and the atypia and said, it's just dense breast tissue.
Right.
You're so young. Most women your age have it. And I called bullshit. So I, again, did more research. I spoke with physicians from all over. I met with genetic counselors and other breast surgeons. And I made the decision to have what's called a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy, which is the removal of both breast tissue, some lymph nodes in some cases, in order to prevent breast cancer.
That's what Angelina Jolie did.
Exactly. So that's what I did. I did that at age 24. And of course, going into that, it was preventative. Well, 4 days after my surgery, I was called with my pathology report.
Yeah.
And they found breast cancer. I was 24 years old. But because I had acted proactively, I did not have to have chemo and I did not have to have radiation.
It's so much for me, like, to absorb.
It's a lot of information.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the really difficult thing, and this goes into a lot of the stigma with women's health, is I received so much you know, condemnation and criticism about me making that decision at such a young age and being a woman, of literally amputating my breasts. I mean, I had a family member who said, no man's ever going to love you without breasts. I had other people, friends, family, who were saying, you know, this is so short, quick after your mom died, you know, you're just being too emotional and too dramatic. You know, just wait. Are you sure? I don't think you should really be doing that. At the time, I was also engaged to be married. No, actually, I was already married. And so they're like, too much change is going on in your life. You can't make this decision. You're just emotional. So anyways, kind of the getting that result, which of course I wasn't excited about, was very vindicating. It was like, so then I felt that was like my calling had been recognized, that what my mom went through and what I went through was to lead me to what I'm doing now. And what that looked like then was I wanted to get involved with preventative care for women. So I ended up becoming a national speaker for Bright Pink, which is a nonprofit that focuses on education and early detection for women between the ages of 18 and 45 for breast and ovarian cancer. And then from there, I was headhunted by the number one genetic testing company in the world, Myriad, to be a national patient speaker for them. And then they moved me into a clinical role, which is what moved me out to Portland. And I was working directly with physicians to train and educate them on how to screen for hereditary cancer syndrome.
And how old are you at this point?
Yeah, I mean, this is all before age 27.
Okay, so moving and shaking.
Yeah. At first I was enjoying it, I think because it was new, but I started getting very jaded because I started realizing, it's like I had this patient experience with both my mom and me, and then now I kind of had this like behind the door view of healthcare.
Right.
And I was realizing that it's about quantity, not quality. That with all these health systems, and it's really, it's not the fault of the physician, it's how healthcare has gone today in the US, is that the more time I spend with a patient means the fewer patients I'm going to see, which means a smaller paycheck.
Yeah.
And I got angry and frustrated that, you know, that is not why they entered into healthcare. And also, you know, that's doing no one any good. So I started kind of just having conversations with women out and about, whether it was grabbing coffee in line and I comment on their cute shoes or something, and we start talking, and the next thing you know, I'm saying, what I'm doing for Myriad, but I'm also then sharing a little bit of my story. And inevitably, every single woman would say, oh my gosh, I've always been really concerned about my breast or my ovarian or my cervical cancer risk because my aunt or my grandmother or my mom had it at such and such age. But my doctor told me that I don't have to be concerned, or I don't have an increased risk, or I'm too young. And I'd have to look at them as not a medical professional and say, that's inaccurate information, that's wrong. And
right, and they're not gonna really believe you because you're not a doctor.
Who am I? Yeah. But then also, having heard my story,
right,
they're like, oh, well, if that happened to you, that could happen to me. Mm. Maybe I do have an increased risk. So now you're doubting the people who are supposed to be the experts, who are supposed to have your best interest in mind. And all these women are having this gut feeling of like, I'm concerned, there's something going on.
You're 27, you're starting to get jaded.
Uh-huh.
So...
started happening at 26, actually.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So did you, like, did this all bubble up into some event, like you quit your job,
totally.
Or?
I quit my job, and honestly, I did not know what I was going to do. I just knew that I was angry, that I was not having enough impact, and that things weren't changing. So it went on like this 10-month expedition of figuring out what the root of the problem is and how I can solve it.
Yes. So what is, first of all, before we even get to the root of the problem, what precisely is the problem?
Okay, so let me give you a couple statistics. So 1 in 3 women will get a female cancer in their lifetime. So we're talking 33%, and that's a statistic from 2010. So it's probably higher. It is higher. So if 33% of women in the United States are going to get a cancer, 60% of those cancers are preventable. 60%.
Uh-huh. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's millions and millions of people.
40% of those cancers happen due to delayed diagnosis. So the problem for me is when I was doing all this research, I'm talking to all these women, I'm meeting with 1.5 million people every day, and I mean, the problem is insurance. The problem is the healthcare system. The problem is the lack of access. The problem is the cost. But the root of the problem,
yeah,
like it's all those things, but the root of the problem is that women don't know what's going on with their breasts and vaginas. And that leads to delayed diagnosis, perpetuating shame, and an increase in disease incidence.
Okay.
And so if women know their bodies, if they know what's going on, then they know when something's abnormal. Then they can have, and if they have access to quality information to know these things, and then to track and watch and see, talk with women who maybe have similar symptoms, then something can be found before it is life-threatening, and we can decrease disease incidence, as well as by equipping the woman with the proper tools, the information to have an informed conversation with her physician, then we can partner with our physicians to make sure that delayed diagnosis doesn't occur. So another story is that in March of this last year, I had my ovaries and fallopian tubes removed preventatively because I have a really high ovarian cancer risk. And I had gotten a result back from my transvaginal ultrasound that was concerning. They didn't think it was going to be anything, but, oh, that was great. They didn't think it was going to be anything, but at that point I was like, you know what? I don't have children, and there is no reason for me to sit on this if there's something I can do. So I made an appointment with a well-respected gynoc, and I went in there and said, I am BRCA1 positive. I had a preventative double mastectomy that resulted in finding breast cancer. I am such and such age. This was my result on my last transvaginal ultrasound. I don't want to have children. So I would like to have my ovaries and fallopian tubes removed so that I don't get this and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, wow, seems like you've done your research.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, well, here's one. She asked me one question, and I said, and I answered it. And she goes, okay, sounds like you thought through this. Let's do it.
Fantastic.
That experience,
yeah,
was wildly different than the one that I had with my breasts when I was much younger and didn't know anything and was deferring to the physician. So that's where this came about of, oh my gosh, if women are the experts, then that can happen. Then not only can we have better experiences in healthcare, but we can prevent diseases. If women know what their risks are, so then they can get to know their bodies, they know what they can do to decrease those risks, they can connect to quality information, learn from each other, then they can be empowered to take the steps to decrease the risks for all these things that have historically affected their family members and women to decrease those numbers. So, yeah,
somebody
Gabby,
in my family had their, surgery.
Hysterectomy,
one ovary removed.
Okay.
And I was like, when she was going through that, I was like, holy cow, you know, really scared.
Right.
But
it's a big thing. It's a really big thing. And you know, the decisions that I made, removing my breasts and removing my ovaries and tubes, that's a personal decision. By no means am I recommending that every woman do that. I'm just saying we have options. And in the United States, our focus is on a cure and treatment instead of prevention. And if the numbers are greater that we can prevent cancer and diseases, really, then why aren't we putting our efforts and our money and our time into that?
Okay, question. So you're 27, you quit your job,
uh-huh.
And did you, you know, file a corporation? Like, what were the concrete steps that you took to realize, you know, your goal?
Yeah. Boy, was it a roller coaster, and it still is. So at first I'm like, oh, women just need access to quality content. Because when I was having these conversations, I didn't feel like I could offer a complete resource to women of, here, go read this or talk to this person and they'll be able to help you with this. So at first, honestly, it was starting out as a blog. And then I started having conversations with, you know, experts in the community, experts in the United States, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, all these places and women themselves, and realized, okay, that's like two small potatoes. So then it was, oh, we need to have like a brick and mortar nationally, think like Planned Parenthood, but that women want to go to, that doesn't feel clinical. You can like, you know, have some matcha lattes and, you know, maybe get your hair done or something while you're waiting to talk with your physician, so that it is more of a community thing than it is going to these sterile hospitals where you're waiting for so long and everyone's in a bad mood.
So did you actually build a space?
Oh, no. This is like I started a blog and then stopped the blog. And then I thought, oh, it needs to be bigger, so it needs to be these brick and mortar. So then I'm pursuing that. And then I'm realizing, wait, like that doesn't solve the problem for access and cost. So then I'm going, oh, you know what, it's insurance. Insurance is so screwed up, that's the problem. And so this is all to get to the part where women need to be experts. Like, I haven't come to that conclusion yet. So then I started, you know, studying all these healthcare startups like Ask Your Health and Tia and Maven Clinic. All of them, I think, are out of New York. Maybe not Tia. And going, oh, I need to create a health insurance that revolutionizes like insurance.
So you try to actually maybe think about creating health insurance.
Totally.
So how did that go?
Well, it just kind of made me sick from day one because it's like such a mess. Like, no one wants to. That's a big undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge undertaking.
Well, and for me, it was like, okay, you know what? Actually, public policy needs to change, not like some, we don't need another health insurance company. It was the conclusion I came to for that. So then finally, I came to the conclusion that women needed something that was with them all the time, every day, that empowered them, that destigmatized the experiences that they had, that connected them to other women who were having similar experiences, that was a very low barrier to entry, so for me that means free, to female patients, and was more of like creating a movement of all these aspects of women's health, from menstruation to menopause.
Yeah.
And I started hosting these focus groups and sending out these surveys. And one of the most powerful things that came out of those focus groups was I had the moderator ask, after doing a couple and realizing it was kind of going this way, was, who taught you how to insert a tampon? 90% of the women at these focus groups were not taught and had to figure it out on their own.
Uh-huh.
And so whether it was reading the back of the Tampax box or mom saying, okay, here's this thing, this is what it does, okay, go in the bathroom and figure that out, that, you know, women were not given a step-by-step instruction, understanding of why and what's going on, how this affects you, what you need to be cautious about, of this thing that, you know, all women typically have a period and they don't know how to handle this.
Yeah.
How is it possible that women don't know that? So then that of course led to the number of women who don't know how to perform a self-breast exam, an actual self-breast exam.
Which is super important.
Yeah, yeah, because 90% of, maybe it's 90. My number. Between 80 and 90% of all breast cancers are discovered by the woman and then confirmed by a physician.
What about, here's a side question, male breast cancer.
Oh, that's the thing, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's also stigmatized.
And like, no one would teach men how to do self-exams.
No, not at all. So, what was I saying?
So you're thinking you need to create some kind of resource or like, you go from a blog to like, identifying real problems that have really sort of basic solutions.
Right, and realizing that we can get around the insurance problem, the cost problem, the physician healthcare quantity over quality problem, if we put the power in the hands of the woman.
Yeah.
So that's how Gabby came about. So Gabby is an app that makes women the experts on their body. And we do that through a personalized risk assessment with actionable insights, a community of women with similar experiences so that you can learn and share from each other, a vetted marketplace.
And what kind of things are in the marketplace?
So it'll be products by women for women.
Okay.
And instructional content, basically, you know, resources, video content that you can learn, like how to insert a tampon or how to perform a self-breast exam that is approachable and not clinical and empowering.
So where is Gabby? Like, is it the idea phase? I know you're looking for an app developer. Like, what are the concrete steps that you have taken so far?
Yeah. So, I think the high level is that I have wireframes. I have the I'm like falling out here. Okay, so I have everything except the app built before that stage. So I offered the job to someone and then they took a more lucrative position, because at this point I'm getting ready to raise money and I'm at that point, I'm kind of at this breaking point where I need money in order to make this happen, or I need someone who is just as passionate as me and is in a place where they can either just work for Equity full time or, you know, whatever that is until I get the full funding. And so we're getting ready to launch a crowdfunding campaign to help kind of mitigate that in the interim. And then when I officially open my raise and try and raise from investors, hopefully I'll be able to do that. So yes, I'm looking for an app developer.
So you're in a spot that I think is the most important. Well, it's a very important spot because I interview all these people who start companies. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of them, just a real emphasis on the maybe, some of them take it for granted, you know, that they found a co-founder. Like the guy I just interviewed yesterday.
Yeah.
He had a technical co-founder. Who had all the right skills, but it's like, it's more than that.
No, I mean, that's also like, sure, I could just get someone and bring them on as a co-founder, but I feel like that's like a marriage. You know, you hear all these stories.
It's more than a marriage.
Right, yeah, exactly. So I'm not gonna enter into that lightly. So I'm exploring two paths of someone who's gonna build it and then continuing to look for who maybe, whether that's the co-founder or bringing on someone as like a CTO, who that person will be. And if that's two people, then fine.
Yes.
If it's one person, great. But I can't rush the process of bringing someone on who's gonna be so highly influential and a big part of this, if they're not the right person.
I think finding a co-founder is exactly like dating, you know, to continue with the marriage metaphor.
Yeah. And there's another thing, there's a big part of me that feels really strongly that this needs to be built by women, for women.
Yeah.
And now, don't get me wrong, I really, men as allies is really important, and there are many men out there who are allies, but, you know, in terms of like investment capital, donations, etc., I'm really wanting this to be built by women and or men who, love a woman, whether it's their sister or their mom or their grandmother or their partner. And so I'm being very picky about who I choose, one, and two, who I take money from. I've already turned down people for investments because of one reason or another that didn't align with
absolutely
our mission or goals.
Absolutely. I mean, the moment you take on an investor, they're going to start driving your car, to use a metaphor.
Yeah.
They'll be a backseat driver.
Yeah.
And, you know, worst case scenario, they'll say, okay, I gave this person my money. They are taking some 15-year grandiose strategy, and that doesn't align with my financial goals. So, you know, I'm going to just view this person as a non-human and, you know, remove them from getting a return on my investment. And yeah. Sometimes investors, you know, that's worst case scenario.
Right. So
finding alignment,
yeah,
I think is so important.
So important. And the thing is, it's not like when I sit down and talk with people who, I'm meeting with an investor here in New York who reached out to me because he read my story somewhere. And one of his family members had breast cancer.
Yeah.
And so, like, those are the people who I want helping build this company. And they're also the ones who realize how big the market is. This is a multi-trillion dollar market.
And just, we didn't say this on camera, but just to be clear, you're trying to make a for-profit company.
Yes. Gabby is a for-profit company. We have a foundation arm as well that will roll out, not immediately. I won't be able to get that up immediately. But the goal essentially is that when...
Hold on. The microphone.
Oh, where is it? Is it there?
Yeah, it was just a little behind you.
Okay. The goal is that every purchase that is made, a woman in need of healthcare services will be supported in underprivileged communities. And I'm keeping that very vague because if it's tampons, then it's tampons. If it's an iPhone so they can have our app, then it's that. If it's, you know, access to a physician, then it's that. So there's a foundation aspect, a nonprofit arm for sure. But I feel like we can do bigger and greater things by being a for-profit company.
Yeah, fantastic.
I'm looking for someone to build the app. If that transitions into a co-founder, fine. If it's more of like a just developer or CTO, whatever. I'm meeting someone who builds, who's a full stack developer.
So what the advice that I can give is it doesn't matter how you build your app, whether you do it through an outsourced agency, whether you build the first part of it through an Upwork contract, you know, and then that gets you a little bit further along the way. It doesn't matter how you do it, as long as you do it.
So that's the thing that's so frustrating is that everyone has opinions about everything. And when you are a first-time startup founder, you have to really be intentional about whose opinions you listen to and value. Because I've gotten everything from, oh my gosh, you can't hire an agency, or you can't hire a dev team. You definitely don't want to do it outside the country. Oh, you should do that. Oh, you need to find the individual. Oh, it needs to be, you know, like there's all these, there's so much information and it can get very, confusing. So I appreciate that feedback.
Yeah. This is coming from me as a developer who can do it myself. But I just know how difficult it is to find a developer. That said, the one thing that has changed since I was a professional developer is that there are a lot more developers these days.
Yeah.
Like as opposed to 10 years ago. So that's in your favor. There's a lot of people. So ultimately it means developers are less expensive. Back when I was a coder, you know, there was like higher salaries because
you were so few.
There were exactly, and we were so essential to the business. So that's one thing working in your favor. The other thing is that don't let the tech kill your company. Like people, like tech can be really expensive.
Right.
And one really good example is, have you seen the show Shark Tank?
Yeah.
So there was this episode where these guys came in, and this is like 10 years ago already. These guys came in, they said, yeah, well, we spent $3 million on the app. Like, we need investors. And they're like, those developers saw you coming from a mile away. And you're toxic, we're not touching you. So just don't let the tech kill it. It's like, it can be ugly too. Like, it can be ugly at first.
Yeah.
And to just get something in people's hands, so to like get you further down the road.
Yep.
Yeah. In some ways, ugly is pretty. Because like...
Then it's a story too.
Yeah.
Like, oh, remember our first iteration?
Exactly. So you're looking to build out the tech component, A. You are...
We have there's a rural health clinic in, system technically, in Oregon, that we have a letter of intent for a pilot. So that's
fantastic.
Yeah, so have that, but that's where it's like, oh my gosh, okay, so I need someone to build this thing, because right now, like, I have a very simple risk assessment up on the website and I'm doing it all manually and it's a shit show. So again, like, it's cool, it's so exciting. I feel like I didn't get time to enjoy and celebrate the first pilot thing because I don't have anyone to build it. And my response was like, oh shit,
yeah,
how am I gonna do this?
Right. More money, more problems.
Right, you know? And I'm starting to like have conversations with insurance companies and then large companies like, you know, the Nikes and stuff of the world to talk about the add-on for the employee benefits.
Now talk about that.
Oh yeah, so essentially because I want the barrier to entry to be minimal, if not nothing, to women, I want the app to be free.
Yeah.
So for that, you know, we are for the consumer first, but we're going to be partnering with businesses, so health insurers, and then as an add-on to employee benefit programs that will be offered to the employees to keep them in their jobs longer so that they can be healthier, so that they can
work. So you know, Lauren figured that out.
Oh yeah, you told me about. Okay, I'd love.
Her health startup figured out how to do, you know, be on insurance.
Okay, yeah. Well, and so here's the other thing is that for insurance, like the money, the cost savings that we provide by getting women to be using Gabby is astronomical for insurance companies.
Yes. So that right there is your why this is a win-win.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, insurance companies may be like, oh, we've done it this way forever, you know, but right. That's making that argument and making that argument stick.
Yes.
You know, is one of your challenges.
Totally. And the reason we're basically going after three methods because the healthcare sales cycle is so slow. So we're going to go after health systems too. But again, the sales cycle
like
is slow.
Glacier.
Right. Insurance, faster. Corporations, even faster. So those are kind of those three methods. And then there will be initially a way that we're monetizing through the consumer for like a one-time fee that can be applied to the products that we would have on the marketplace.
Well, I think your business model is going to go through lots of iterations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It already has.
So what's your roadmap? Like, are you giving yourself some set amount of time, like 6 months, 2 years?
To
raise money or make a profit or?
Definitely. So as soon as going to launch this crowdfunding campaign and then have that up for about a month, get money from that. That is what I will use to then pay someone to build this thing. And
to build Gabby.
Yeah, to build the first iteration of the app. And I'm also hoping to get accepted to, So that would be happening in January. And ideally, like my goal would be that at the end of that we would have already launched like the app, the first iteration or be in beta or something. And then.
Yeah, so.
Off to the races.
There's this old thing in the tech world called like waterfall, which is like work on it for like a year and make it perfect, 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 and then release it. And but the problem is, by the time you do that and release it, the market has already shifted. And
right. We're gonna have to launch multiple times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And it's like you were saying, you know, we just need to get something in people's hands, and then while they're testing it, we're building that next, you know, version as we're learning from our customers.
Perfect.
Yeah. So there's that. And then depending if the incubator thing happens in the new year, which I'm saying it is, that thing happening, I would get a certain amount of investment from that. And ideally would either open and close around kind of during that, or would then open it after.
Now, what experience, I know you had a real amazing career with advocacy in the pharmaceutical industry or medical industry?
Yeah, medical industry.
What experience do you have with, you know, raising money? Because people throw that term around just willy-nilly, but they don't understand that, like, you are one, you are putting yourself in a position where it's like you're creating so much pressure for yourself, which can be good, but it's just like,
yes,
the only problem is if your thing is just too early. Like, you can get money, people will give people money, but it might be too early for that. Like, a lot of startups fail.
Right. So that's so interesting, because like in the Portland startup community, I'm too early. I go to San Francisco or like New York,
yes,
and I'm not. And so I've already said that because like the Portland startup culture just hasn't evolved to that level, that I'm not raising in Portland. So in terms of how much experience do I have raising money? Yeah, I mean, I worked for nonprofits and was at certain points was in charge of raising money or getting corporate sponsorships, etc. But I still think that is, so I have that experience, but I still think that's very different than right, like what I'm raising capital to build this startup, to make it profitable, etc. So that's another part of, you know, being a startup founder is so hard, because I don't know what I don't know. I have to, this is going back to like who you listen to. I need to surround myself with people who have done this before, who are experienced, and identify who are those people that I'm gonna trust and ask for wisdom, because so much of this is like the blind leading the blind. And I need help. And I think that's one of the biggest resources that I think is lacking out there for entrepreneurs and startup founders. Mm. So anyways, that being said, I've taken a couple master classes on raising capital. So I've done that. I did a virtual accelerator with Founders Gym.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
So I've done a lot of these things to educate myself, and I have a really great community of female startup founders. So we're all learning and sharing from each other. And
that's how I found you.
Yeah, exactly.
I can just, from my experience, I made one app and it had some like financial success, but I failed to turn that app into a business. Like, I suffer from maybe giving up too early, you know, like seeing some failure and then being like, oh,
you know, it's not gonna happen.
I wasn't vulnerable. I just like said, okay, it's not working, move on to the next thing.
Okay. And honestly, like, especially when you're a solo founder, you have to do that. And I think even if you're not a solo founder, you have to talk with people who are in a similar space, who are further ahead than you, who are further behind than you, who are right where you are.
Further behind.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you have to talk to so many people and just learn, because you don't know, and the best way to learn is from experience. And so learning from people's prior experiences is, or past experiences, is invaluable.
At the same time, you're going after something.
That it's different and new, so no one really knows how to do it.
And you're going to learn things by doing it yourself.
Right. And at the end of the day, if you're not willing to take risks, then it's not gonna happen. And that can be scary.
It can be scary. But I don't think that's gonna stop you, Caitlin.
No, it's not. It's scary and it's lonely and it's really hard, but you know, I'm not doing this. I maybe that's the kind of like set apart, is that I feel like it's for a bigger purpose than than me. It's for, it's, you know, I am out to create systemic change. I am out to have impact. And so I'm not going to stop. I'm willing to pivot if it looks differently,
yes,
which we'll have to,
yes,
and already have. But I think because it's bigger than just me, that I don't have a choice to give up. That's how I feel.
Yeah. Yes. So tell me, like, how did it come up?
Yeah. So, you know, this all started with my mom, right? Well, her her full name is Lisa Gabrielle Tevenet Clark. And so Gabrielle, obviously, Gabby comes from Gabrielle. And one of the things that I think is even just, to me, like when this happened, there's many things that also, I don't know, you know, if you believe in everything happens for a reason or whatever, but just the kismet of the name here is really powerful to me, and just confirmation that this is going to happen and be big. So Gabby, my mom and I were both often said we were too opinionated, too strong, too talkative. And I think one of the strongest qualities of women is that we share information.
Yeah.
And so Gabby is empowering women to gab and to share about their body, to learn about their body with one another.
Here's a hardball question for you.
Do it.
Let's talk competition in your space.
Sure.
You know, there are other health companies out there.
Yep.
There are probably other women-focused health companies out there.
A ton.
What do you think, and they're all vying for A, customers, B, venture capital.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of all of that?
So, great question. I think the first is that there are a ton of women specifically. I'm kind of going to discount the female health startups that are by men because I think that's wrong.
Sure.
So the female health startups that are headed by women, led by women, there are a ton of great ones and they're doing incredible things. Again, I think I mentioned a couple before. There's Tia and Maven and there's Modern Fertility. The difference, I think, our differentiator is that we're solely focusing on prevention, and it's things that can be prevented. So preventable disease. The other is that we're creating a movement. So I think all of those other startups are doing something different, doing the same thing in a different way, if that makes sense. So they are leveraging, I think, the health system and insurance in order to create something different and more accessible to consumers, which is needed. We have stats that need to be met. You know, decreasing delayed diagnosis is very specific.
Yes.
And that's what we're doing. And in doing so, we're wanting to get women to talk about their bodies, to not have the shame and stigma of learning how to put in a tampon, of being okay talking about those subjects, of feeling their breasts. And so I think the second thing is that we're creating not just a company, but a movement. We want to be in your hands all the time. We want to be your best friend, your resource that you go to, that you can trust. And in order to decrease delayed diagnosis and decrease disease.
I think what you're doing is important, and I it seems like you have a realistic and practical approach to it, and we all know that you're a problem solver and that you get things done. So in that I have confidence in. There's no doubt in my mind that this is your purpose. So let's leave it at that. You know, you're just at the beginning of the journey. You know, this is really early, but
don't say that. It's not that early. It's been a year.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I'm just kidding. But you're right. In relative terms, yeah. And like 10 months of that was research, and yes.
So a quote that I want to bring up from Drew, who Drew Austin, who's been on the show, and he's most entrepreneurs are not familiar with the cycle of success and failure.
Mm.
And he's, you know, he's been starting companies for like 20 years. And just that resonated with me because, you know, when you go relative, to me, like, for something as big as yours, it's like 10 months is nothing. Like,
yeah, you're totally right. You're very right. Thank you. I also think I'm the hardest on myself, and I am as hard as could. Yeah. So it's great always to get other people's perspectives and tell them to have them tell me to get my head out of my ass and not be so hard on myself.
Well, then it goes to what Rachel said. Hearing you say that, it goes to what Rachel said, which is founder, you know, health is such a thing, because what we're trying to do, you know, in starting these things is really difficult.
Yes.
And it's so difficult that you can like put yourself in a position where you know you might be doing unhealthy things.
Totally. Well, I was just having a conversation with a friend, actually. Because I feel like this is my higher purpose, and because I don't want any more women to be hurt, to experience what my mom and I experienced, I am willing to make all the sacrifices. What I have to be good at, and one of my mentors said this to me, is like, if you're not healthy, your company is going to fail.
Yeah.
And although I'm willing to make all these sacrifices, and I'm willing to, you know, wake up early and stay up late and not go and do fun things and, you know, work on the weekends, whatever it is, pinch pennies, at the end of the day, if I'm not taking care of myself, then yeah, my company is going to fail. So there's like this, there's a happy medium of being dedicated and putting the time and hard work in, but then also being okay with saying, you know what, I need a day off, or I need that extra hour of sleep, or I need to go start spending money on a therapist, or whatever it is. And I'm kind of a all or nothing kind of gal.
Yeah.
So I definitely go to extremes, and in the unhealthy way, that can be like me just 150% all work.
Yep.
Which then burns you out and then sick. Like, I got the flu in July.
Right.
Who does that happen to? No one.
Founders.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the final question.
Okay.
And I think it's the most important question of the show. Okay. So, and I ask it to everybody who comes on. So, Caitlin, how do you believe you have grown as an entrepreneur? In what ways?
It's a great question. I think my personality is that I like to be in control. And I don't think I've learned more or worked harder than since I started Gabby. And I think the first thing that comes to mind is that I've gotten okay or more comfortable with the unknown, with being uncomfortable. And I think as a business owner in the startup world, you have to be, you don't have a choice. So that's the first thing. Oh, like being okay, not being in control all the time.
Yeah. For you, because you always want to control and make manifest what you dream and like make it real.
Yeah.
So I think that right there is huge.
Yeah. So I would say that's the big one.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, that's it. We're done.
Cool. So good. Thank you.
Oh, well, we're almost done. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yes. Thank you.
So where should people go? Like.
Oh. Uh-huh, good question.
Go
so,
to Get Gabby.
So our domain website is begabby.com. So BEGABBI.com. Our social media handles are begabby. So that's where you can go check us out. You can sign up to be on our newsletter list. You can take the risk assessment that's online and follow us on social media on all of the platforms to learn about what we're doing, where we're going, and our success, and how you can get Gabby in your hands.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap.